Hi everyone, welcome back to the 21 and Sensory podcast with me, Emily. On today's episode, I have the lovely Rosemary Richings. Rosemary is a dyspraxic pro writer, editor, author, and neurodiversity advocate. Currently, Rosemary is serving on the board of trustees of Dyspraxic Me, which is a UK-based charity providing peer support for dyspraxics aged 16 to 25. She is also a founding member of Dyspraxic Alliance, along with a Dyspraxia magazine panel member. Rosemary is originally from Toronto, Canada, but moved to Marrakesh, which is in Morocco, in 2021. Rosemary is on the podcast today not only to chat about herself and her life, but also her book, Stumbling Through Space and Time, Living Life with Dyspraxia, which was published by Jessica Kingsley Publishers in September 2022. In it, Rosemary shares her experience of growing up dyspraxic and how it impacts her sense of space, time, coordination, and a whole lot more, which I'm sure I'll get into. So, Rosemary, would you like to say hello?
Hi, everyone. Yeah, thanks for having me.
So, in the intro, I mentioned that you are dyspraxic, and I think it would be really interesting to start with that diagnosis, and if you could give me a little bit more background in terms of support within education and what it was like growing up.
Well, I'm quite an unusual case because I was diagnosed really young. I was only four at the time, so there's only so much I remember. But yeah, so I always open with disclosing that. But I was four, and it was after a lengthy period of time where I felt like I practically lived at the local children's hospital, where it was just one test after another. My parents were aware of something being up. I was learning how to walk slower. I fell down the stairs at one point, one of my parents told me, and I was learning key stuff like riding a bike and reading and such at a slower rate. So they decided to go and get me tested, and after a lengthy period of time of going and getting MRIs, blood tests, getting a psychological evaluation in my local community, they had found at the time it was a really new thing. So I feel it was very much a learning curve for the medical practitioners as well. They were like, oh, it's this new thing of dyspraxia that we're only just starting to learn more about. And my dad is actually originally grew up in Britain. So what actually helped us was Britain was a bit more ahead of the curb on having some level of resources. Mm-hmm. Back then, it was really the early days of Dyspraxia Foundation. And he had got a hold of a brochure on that subject. And that was really where the whole process began.
Okay. And so did it kind of, it kind of sparked from your parents? Did they sort of notice this in you, if that makes sense?
Yeah, it was my parents above all else. And mm-hmm. teachers were kind of figuring there was something up, but they didn't know what mm-hmm. specifically.
And in what ways were you kind of struggling? Just in case, I think you might be one of the first dyspraxic people on my podcast. So it'd be really interesting if you could give a kind of, you know, what you kind of struggled with at that age and more about what dyspraxia is.
Yeah, so at that age I was struggling with learning how to ride a bike. I was learning basic sort of self-care things like dressing myself, tying my shoelaces, things like that. Mm-hmm. But also people were finding that there was certain learning environments from a sensory point of view too that made it very difficult for me to focus. Like I was really struggling in school, so mm-hmm. that basically made people assume that it was something learning based, something neurological based, and I had to be tested further.
Okay. And So really it's your fine like motor skills, is that right?
Yeah, fine motor skills.
Yeah.
Yeah, and processing of movement-based instructions. Mm-hmm. people, dyspraxics often have that early story of PE class and finding that they were learning how to catch a ball at a slower rate. They couldn't get by in team sports as well because the instructions wouldn't process as well. Mm-hmm. And that was definitely the case for me.
Okay, so there's quite a lot to it in terms of kind of the motor skills and like hand-eye coordination, and also, like you said, the processing as well. Were your school able to actually provide you any like support once you knew this about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, fortunately the special education system at the time was very good. They didn't have as much awareness of dyspraxia, but they had awareness of ADHD and autism lot earlier. So I really, looking back, I remember that a lot of my accommodations were very similar to that, because they didn't necessarily have the awareness of dyspraxia so much, but they at least were starting to think about what you needed to accommodate people with neurodivergent conditions in general.
Okay. Well, that's nice to hear, because a lot of people who come on here and have, you know, kind of, even if they found out kind of early on about a diagnosis, they might not get the support within education. But it sounds like, you know, you actually had access to at least some form of support, which is always nice to hear.
Yeah, in the special education system, but in terms of teachers, it was kind of mixed. I mean, some really just were really by the book and didn't see neurological things as a reason to make an exception in any way, and felt that certain things had to be taught in a certain way, and that was the only way it was going to go about.
Mm-hmm. And did you find, is there kind of a learning style that suits you better? Like, would you say you're more of a like visual learner, or more someone that kind of learns better like verbally? Like, have you found kind of a learning style that suits you?
I'm definitely more of a visual learner. That is definitely carried in my adulthood, where I have always just, whenever I really have no idea what someone's telling me to do, I'm always like, please write this down. Please give me a visual representation of this, and then it will all start to click a little bit more.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So almost like a combination of things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And so how kind of the older you got, was it kind of the same sort of struggles, or did things kind of like, did you always kind of struggle with the same things, or did you find you got kind of better at certain things? Like, how did dyspraxia grow with you, if that makes sense?
Yeah, I mean, I at least started to slowly find coping mechanisms for the motor skills side of things. Mm-hmm. But unfortunately, I mean, you have mixed days. You have some days where you're under stress, or you're just having a bad day in general where that doesn't work as much. Yeah. And I found as I grew as well, like into teenage years, it was all things that were much more awkward in the sense of social pressure. It was the social ritual of putting makeup on and dressing certain ways starts to stick out more. And I really found I had to like quietly find ways to people who I trusted to teach me those things, because I couldn't just be in a social group and be putting lipstick on, for example, and for that to be a simple and straightforward process.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, even just like your teenage years are pretty horrible anyway, in terms of like puberty and like, you know, knowing like spatial awareness and stuff, and like when your body's changing and stuff like that. So to have this other layer on top of that must have been, like you're saying, like quite difficult to navigate in like social situations, and like, you know, people expecting you to, like you say, be able to put makeup on and things like that. It must be quite tricky.
Yeah, you know, I really had to like work at finding ways that like I could at least pass as neurotypical, because it wasn't like considered cool, and more just I had to like learn these things in my own way and find a way that it could it could be obvious without standing out.
Mm-hmm. And I know we'll come onto your book in a little bit, but I know that you kind of mentioned sort of coping with bullies in school and also like trying to choose a like dyspraxia friendly university. Could you talk kind of more around that?
Yeah, in terms of bullies, that goes back to this body image and social situations thing, because you do kind of start to stick out in terms of you're dressing differently, or you don't want to conduct the same rituals as other people, or you're not fitting a type, and that can really make it much more difficult to get support, because then you're internalizing during the key years that that is somehow not acceptable to be that way. And that is really where bullying comes into play. And I mean, that was very much what I had to deal with at one point around then because of it. And I think because we don't have strong enough support networks for dyspraxic and neurodivergent people up until recently, it has really meant that people don't feel strong enough to say, like, what if my way of doing things is fine? And just kind of are more likely to internalize that, like, yeah, the bully's right, you know?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. It can be really hard to, like, stand up to that when you don't know any different.
Yeah, exactly. And that's why I felt it was important to write about it, too, because I think, if you don't have the tools and you think they're right, how can you stand up to them?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and just being, like, your own self-advocate is really tricky. It's tricky now as an adult, I find. So I can only kind of think about how on earth I stood up to people when I was younger.
Yeah, and I didn't really develop that skill as much really as I got older, as I started to be in the university years, that I went from having that process quite handheld along with me to suddenly like, okay, what do you need? And finding out, I actually don't know. And that being the source of complication, having an awkward period, I made the mistake of when I first started university of I actually didn't disclose. I didn't actually go and get the right support. I didn't get the right support because I was just really overwhelmed and I didn't know what to do. And I had to really like start keeping a diary and doing a lot of self-reflection to really decide what I needed.
Mm-hmm. And when did you kind of decide, did it get to a point where you felt like you needed to kind of disclose it in order to get some help?
Oh yeah. By first year, I was having all kinds of situations where I, even at sort of courses and things like that I'm actually good at, where I was starting to fail, I was starting to forget about deadlines and things like that. And suddenly I was like, I really need to get some help. I need to stop being so proud of myself.
Mm-hmm. And that must have been quite like tricky almost, like, because did you find that kind of people knew you as a certain kind of person, and like, did you tell kind of, you know, people on the course, or was it just kind of the main university? Because I don't know if you were kind of worried about maybe the stigma or people not understanding what dyspraxia actually is.
I think it got easier in terms of stigma by then, because I went to a very like progressive liberal arts college, mm-hmm. where everyone was like, the really cool thing to do at the time was to come out as gay or talk about having a mental health condition or something like that. Mm-hmm. And even just being around that kind of peer group was part of really helping me learn to accept it, learn to love it in a way, as much as feel like it's something overwhelming.
Mm-hmm. Okay, that sounds quite nice, like in terms of it being kind of almost more of a community and more like open and honest with each other.
Yeah, but even then, I don't think they knew explicitly what issues, because I didn't know how to put it into words yet.
Mm-hmm. And would you say that you've kind of, do you know how to put it into words now? Like, at what point did you of get to it?
Later on in university, I was really heavily involved in the drama club. Mm-hmm. And that really helped me start to like practice being someone who just puts these things to into words and gave me a voice to do that. Mm-hmm. And I was keeping a diary quite habitually by then, so I was starting to notice a lot of patterns. Mm-hmm. And that was really what helped me find the language and the vocabulary for it.
Okay. It's really interesting to hear that kind of, like, I always like to talk to people about like their kind of like the process they've been through in terms of like education, because you can kind of see almost like sometimes like the evolution or the kind of like journey that people go through in order to like understand themselves. And it, you know, it's even more interesting because you were diagnosed so young and you kind of, you know, potentially knew it sooner than someone else might. But how did you find the kind of like transition between like different kind of schools and universities and to say like, you know, like the workplace and stuff like that? How did you find kind of coming up to those sort of stages in your life?
In terms of the school side of things, it varied. I mean, earlier on, it was just a nicer, more socially progressive environment. But it was always very overwhelming to feel like to need to have to repeat many of those steps and make all those reintroductions. The change was the harder bit. And once I got into the workplace, it's the same thing, especially because my early experiences with that weren't places that really encourage sort of neurodivergent thinking. They were like with customer service jobs and things like that, where the normal was more being outgoing and saying everything that you're thinking and trying to pick up on certain things rather than any kind of difference, really. So yeah, the change was the harder bit.
Mm-hmm. And I read on your website that you kind of like transitioned into kind of more freelance sort of work. What kind of made you decide to go more sort of like that route?
Yeah, later on in university, I was starting to work more in the not-for-profit sector, and that was really the first time that I felt that I could sit down quietly and not have to be this person that I'm not. And as I graduated, I started to find it really hard to get into more 9-to-5 stuff, but I had a strong blog by then. I was already had some connections. Mm-hmm. And I was just like, well, I know how I like to work, so why not just embrace that? Mm-hmm. And so I started to build up a portfolio a little bit more as I was finishing up a job at a theater company. And then I started to get some work and try out what works for me. And here I am 8 years later.
So it's working for you then, if 8 years later,
it. Yeah. Yeah, it was hard to figure out more of the skills part of it at first, the admin and the selling myself and all that at first. But mm-hmm. once I found more of a stronger niche, that's when I started to feel more comfortable.
Mm-hmm. And I kind of feel like people don't necessarily realize that about freelance work, is that you become the boss, you become an administrator, you become marketing, like you become everything for yourself in order to get the work in.
Yeah, and I really feel like that should be discussed more in order to, because there's so many talented creative people who go into it with no awareness of the fact that you need these skills. Mm-hmm. And that's a shame, because that leads to so many people being left under the radar.
Mm-hmm. And are you someone that likes kind of routines and stuff? Like, do you have a kind of structure to your day at all, like in terms of working?
What really helps, I had less of a routine at first when I first started, mm-hmm. but as soon as I moved in with my partner, now spouse, he has type 1 diabetes. So I find that it really helps balance out the day, because everything is oriented around meal times, because he has to take his insulin at a certain time and regulate mm-hmm. his blood sugar. So, and I found I've really thrived on that because I've really been able to experiment with what works for me for like when I do emails, what times in terms of calls I'm the most alert, most awake, most up for it.
Mm-hmm.
And really everything just becomes about always like starting and ending by a certain meal time. And that keeps me really focused and really aware of like when I produce my best work.
Mm-hmm. And I guess also that kind of, in a good way, forces you to stop and have a break.
Yeah, yeah. Because sometimes, like, especially because I'm lucky enough to be very passionate about what I do, I can get too much into hyper-focus mode. And then, then the next thing I know, it's like, oh, I haven't eaten anything yet. And it's almost 3 p.m.
Okay. I get you. So actually, that routine's kind of, you know, working for both you and your other half, which sounds good.
Yeah.
So how did you find kind of moving? I you know, it's really interesting when you first contacted me to be like, I live in Marrakesh. And I was like, wow. Like, what kind of, I know that it kind of was sort of like dependent on, you know, your partner and sort of like living there for his job and things like that. I didn't know if you wanted to explain that a bit.
Mm-hmm. Well, we had to be on the European time zone because he got a really good consulting gig with the WHO, and I was starting to work with more UK and European clients anyway, so it was helpful for me too.
Mm-hmm.
And it was really overwhelming at first because we had to do a lot of looking around, which at what places we were going to go to and all that.
Mm-hmm.
And that meant that the routine was thrown out the window and suddenly anxiety kicked in. And I was, with sensory issues, it always meant there was a particular point in the day where I just couldn't handle like actually talking to people.
Mm-hmm.
I would just need to rest and close the door and have all the lights off. But once we found a place, as long as we had a routine, as long as we didn't always have to be within the noise and the chaos and the action of the city itself, as long as when we went out was like a controlled experience,
mm-hmm.
then we started to be more comfortable.
Okay, that's good. And I imagine, where were you living in Toronto looking for places like online kind of thing, or were you able to like visit Marrakesh and have a look?
We looked at place on an online database of places that was kind of like an equivalent of eBay, but for real estate.
Okay.
And yeah, and we started to ask around. My big tip about the culture here is like the best way you can get good results on anything is if you start to meet people and just explicitly say what you're looking for,
because mm-hmm.
everything's so family oriented that people always know someone mm-hmm. that has the right things.
And how did you find, in terms of like you mentioned like sensory issues and stuff, like how did you find kind of moving as a whole, but also maybe even to the extent of like the environment and the weather and stuff and like that sort of change, like how did you kind of cope with that like shift in place?
Yeah, I mean, we had some exposure to the city before. It was kind of a fine where when we first got married, we went on our honeymoon here and spent a long period of time here.
Oh.
So I had some awareness of what it was. And it is really, it's got an international reputation of being a very loud, very noisy place.
Mm.
So everything had to be very carefully structured around the rule that we are not always in the center of the noise,
mm.
that we can be in a part where we can just like go somewhere quiet and it's fine. And the noise is more something we choose. And I had to learn to be really kind with myself, realize that like sometimes the symptoms themselves would show up in more severe ways,
mm.
because I'd be overwhelmed. And I just had to allow a lot of time to get used to the simple everyday, like going to the shops and things like that.
Mm-hmm. Well, it sounds like you did it in like the best way possible, in terms of like you really like thought about it beforehand and you kind of broke it down into little steps, like, you know, like being able to go to the shop and things like that. Like, that's even, like, big for me. And I've always lived in the UK. So I can only imagine what it must be like to, like, try and get used to it somewhere else.
Oh, yeah, yeah. I never thought I was going to be in anywhere else but Canada, or maybe the UK because I have family there. But, like, it really, because of these things, I never knew what to expect. But mm-hmm. fortunately, at least my partner is aware of my issues. So it really meant we were very mindful and slow and conscientious with the whole process.
Mm-hmm. And so moving on to your book, did this kind of... when did this sort of become something that you thought you might like to do, or was it something that you'd kind of written about? Because I know obviously you're a writer, like, had you always been kind of in the background writing about yourself?
Well, it was always a maybe for a long time. I mean, I did use many diary entries from years back, but I didn't know if I was going to do it or how I was going to do it for a long time.
Mm-hmm.
And then right around just before the pandemic, I got in touch with, I was working out of a co-working space, and I got in touch with someone who works in the publishing industry,
mm-hmm.
who took on a limited amount of new authors as mentors, sort of mentoring program sort of stuff. And I had already started to do sort of a rough idea of what I wanted to put together. I was going to call the Shut Up and Write group, which means that, like, the whole point is that you go and no social media, no other distractions, no nothing, just for a sustained amount of time, you just sit down and write a certain amount of times per week.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a rough idea, but I was starting to get really lost with it. And he liked the idea of it, so I started to go to see him regularly. And that really helped me flesh out the general idea of it. And I did several drafts, and then I started to query around about a year or two later.
Mm-hmm. And was it quite sort of daunting approaching publishers or, you know, agents? Like, how did you find that experience? Because I know it can be quite harsh, and it can be quite, like, blunt with rejections and things.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, it's a tough process. I admit, too, that it's a weird time to be querying, because people are saying they want diversity, but they haven't thought about what it involves to actually properly accommodate or think about diversity, especially when it comes to disabled people.
Mm-hmm.
So there's sort of a weird double standard of, you think you're getting someone who's going to be, like, really interested in that kind of story, but in all reality, they're looking for something that is not you and not your voice. It is a very, like, Hollywood one-dimensional idea of it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was very lucky where I found JKP, where they already had that existing audience for neurodiverse books. And they were really the first time I experienced any genuine excitement and interest and, like, someone who really, really got it.
Mm-hmm. And I also think that there's just, I always found that when I was researching into kind of neurodiverse things like sensory processing disorder, like, there was just, like, no literature from, like, adults. Like, and I feel like that's also kind of the same with dyspraxia. Like, yours is the only book that I've actually really kind of come across online so far that is kind of, you know, a memoir of your life, but actually kind of you as an adult and talking about, like, you know, how you are, like, managing and things like that. And I feel like that's what people want in a book about, you know, dyspraxia or autism or something like that, that they just want, like, your lived experience, because that is so, like, key to being, like, felt like you're understood and felt like you're, like, being seen. So you saying about, like, publishers, yeah, not being, like, you know, coming around to the idea of diversity and not actually really knowing what they want, I can definitely see that, because it's quite hard to find these good books. And at least, you know, publishers like JKP, actually, you know, that's what there is at the forefront of their kind of I don't know, I guess their whole kind of mission.
Yeah, I mean, that's part of why I wanted to write it too, because the only other one I'd found was also through JKP. It was Caged in Chaos.
Okay.
And that was really like one of very few lived experience perspectives I had ever found. And everything else was just like YouTube channels and things like that. But yeah, I mean, there's a lot of people there who are looking for support. I'm plugged in all these groups all the time. I'm part of all these events, and people have more questions than answers. And so they need accessible sort of answers to things.
Mm-hmm. And say someone's listening and they're potentially interested in the book, what would you say is maybe the audience for it? Would you say it's obviously for people who are dyspraxic, but would you say it's for kind of, you know, carers and like parents and things? Like, what would you say is the kind of audience?
Yeah, the majority of the people who have approached me, honestly, who have found the most value in it, have been parents. There have been some recently diagnosed people, but it's been parents, it's been teachers, it's been people in more bureaucratic institutions where they just work with neurodivergent people on a much broader level.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, of course, people who are recently diagnosed or think they might have a diagnosis, just trying to figure out what it even is and get a bit of guidance and sort of learn if what they're experiencing is normal, but also if it's their family member or someone they've been working with through their work, how they can support them.
Mm-hmm. And would you say kind of throughout this process, there's stuff that you've kind of maybe realized about yourself, or, you know, looking back through old like diary entries and stuff like that, do you feel like you've kind of come to terms with more things or uncovered like more things along the way of like writing the book?
Oh yeah, it's been an incredible process because most of my resource material has been old medical documentation. It's been asking questions I've never got to ask before to family members and things like that. And I feel like I've got a bigger picture of what actually happened with the process and how other people were involved. And it gave me a real appreciation for all the things that later on from the support I was able to get,
mm-hmm.
that all the things I was able to do.
Mm-hmm. And I guess that is kind of the difficult thing that people might not appreciate about having an earlier diagnosis is that, you know, you were four and of course you were there, but you weren't really present in terms of, you know, understanding it or having the memories of it. Whereas people who are late diagnosed at least are like involved in the process, if that kind of makes sense.
Yeah, yeah, no, that's definitely true. I mean, they're involved in the process and I often hear that there's a whole self-discovery element. Mm. But yeah, when you're diagnosed young, that's really just the disadvantage. You don't know what's going on. You just see what you're going through is normal, and mm-hmm. that's about it.
Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, again, you're also kind of going through the same process as someone who's late diagnosed, and that you still need to kind of discover it.
Yeah, self-discovery.
It's mad. It's interesting, like the kind of the pros and cons of it all.
Yeah.
It'd be interesting to discuss your like disability advocacy work, because I know you're a trustee of Dyspraxic Me, which I have heard of because I worked with Jess on Sensory Street as like we were both like research assistants on it.
Oh yeah, I heard about that whole project.
Yeah. So I do know of about Jess, but I know that you also kind of do like the Dyspraxic Me peer groups. So maybe we could chat a bit about that.
Yeah, I'm involved on a trustee level. She brought me in on because of my marketing knowledge.
Mm-hmm.
And so I've regularly been attending the meetings to look at all the paperwork, all the budgets, all the decisions around research things that might happen, what events will happen, and seeing what I can do to more get the word out more and support her with all the events she organizes during the year and making sure that there's more funding going towards the organization itself.
Mm-hmm. And it's aimed at age 16 to 25, is that right?
Yeah.
The kind of support group. So what are those kind of, have they sort of transition to more kind of like online stuff, or is it still kind
of
in person?
Yeah, I joined around the time when it was really in the COVID influx.
Mm-hmm.
So it was really like it started to be more online driven.
Mm-hmm.
And it's only recently that they started to introduce more in-person things like their events and their workshops and things like that.
Okay, that's interesting. I'll make sure to link below in case anyone's interested. So I'll pop the link to Dyspraxic Me in the show notes. And I know that you've also done kind of sort of, you say that you're kind of like a speaker, and you've done sort of like talks and things like that. Is that something that you want to do kind of more of this year?
Oh yeah, I had an incredible experience last year where I got to do some more corporate talks on dyspraxia in the workplace for Reach PLC, who runs a lot of the major magazines and newspapers in the UK,
mm-hmm.
and also a group called Fast Company. And it was an incredible experience because I felt like I really got the discussion going, and really was like, it was my first induction, I would say, beyond my writing work,
mm-hmm.
to more the mainstream outlook on it. And I really felt like I got to really be involved in changing some outlooks on hiring neurodivergent people and supporting neurodivergent people and what that can look like and what people typically go through.
Mm-hmm.
And I found that hugely rewarding.
Mm-hmm. And I think it's so important. I feel like last year, especially, like I've noticed more and more companies are talking more about like diversity, which is great, but also more about like neurodivergent like support groups and like employee networks for like neurodiverse people. And that's really like the first time I've ever seen that in terms of like me applying as like an employee. Like it's been so nice to see like internal support from a company and not having to, you know, worry about whether or not to like disclose whether, you know, I have a neurodiverse condition or not, because they're already, you know, aware of it if they've got a network. And you know, you doing these talks and things like that, it's so like great to hear, because I think it's, you know, work is such a big part of our lives, and obviously helps us live. But you know, being supported in work is huge. Like you can actually like excel and be on a level playing field with, you know, neurotypical people if you have that support and just understanding, I think.
Yeah, I've really found that it's been an incredible period of time where, because like all this isolation is forcing people to really confront their own mental health,
mm-hmm.
In a way, and that's sort of tied into all the other forms of neurodivergence as well. And it's been amazing to talk to people I find quite corporate, both in terms of the speaking engagements, but I had the chance to work with some neurodiversity consultants, mm-hmm. as well, on some of the resources and such,
mm-hmm.
and even to just talk to people I would have never associated with finding any value at all in that way of thinking, and for them to be really, really open and keen and interested and really trying harder to understand and to accommodate, because as someone diagnosed in the 90s, I've seen a real huge evolution, huge shift in how we think about all these things.
Mm-hmm. And also that like we are desirable, like for the way that we think and the way we approach work and the way that we may, I don't know, problem solve and things like that, like flipping the narrative of, you know, a diagnosis potentially being like a negative thing to talk about as, you know, as like a new hire or something like that, when actually it could be, you know, recognized by companies as something that's really positive and actually sets you apart almost. Like it can be such a good thing. And I almost wish employers understood that, like, we want these people.
Yeah, I think we're slowly getting there. I think the fact that people are even talking about it is positive.
Mm.
It's just we need to apply it to more sectors, more situations, more cultures, more environments.
Yeah, definitely. I feel like this could be a podcast episode in itself, this topic.
Yeah.
Just like neurodiversity in the workplace as its own, like, separate thing. So I was going to ask you, obviously, you're very busy. You do all these different things. What do you do in your downtime, if you have any? Like, what are your hobbies? What are your special interests? That sort of thing. Because I always like to know a little bit, you know, as much as we've talked about kind of work and what you do professionally, it's nice to know a bit about you and, like, what you get up to.
Yeah, I mean, I'm really into a lot of punk and indie music and indie arts and culture. I've always had a real sense of curiosity. That's what I love about travel, of figuring out what creatively people are creating locally. I the punk side of things and the alternative music side of things, I've always been hugely excited about how they force people to stand up for themselves and how they have a strong, like, going against the status quo element. I always found that really comforting, and it always, like, helped me get through so much of my life and really be braver about sort of sticking up for myself. And yeah, I play a lot of Paradox video games with my husband. I'm really into The Sims. And reading is an obvious one. I mean, I grew up with a lot of series of unfortunate events and Harry Potter and things like that. And now I read more, like, really psychological themed books, I guess I would describe it as.
Do you find that kind of your work and, like, special interest of, like, kind of dyspraxia almost, like overlap a bit? Because I find, like, people that I've talked to who are an autistic content creator, like, their special interest is also autism, and it just, like, beautifully overlaps.
Yeah, I mean, that feels like such a beautiful privilege. It took me so many years to get there, but, like, yeah, I would say in a way it sort of does. Like, even the video games, in a way, I feel like even when I'm playing them, even though they're so distant from my own reality, it always leads to some brilliant thought around something I want to do next.
Mm-hmm. And, like, especially, like, things like The Sims and stuff, where you can almost, I don't know, just, like, live a different life. And, like, it's almost like a form of escapism in, like, a great way.
Yeah.
You could just set up your own little world. Like, there's something really, like, satisfying about that.
Yeah, or, like, play something where you're on Mars or something so distant from reality, or even throw on Rocky Horror Picture Show and just, like, laugh and dance for a while or something like that.
It sounds good. And I feel like we should probably mention, like, where people can kind of find out more information about you, and also where can people buy your book, because I feel like we should have mentioned that earlier.
Okay. Well, in terms of where people can find more information about me, my main one is my website, rosemaryrichings.com, basically my first name and my last name. And I'm on LinkedIn, I'm on Twitter, I'm on Mastodon, I'm on Instagram. I do my best to post regularly, but sometimes it can be a bit tiring. But yeah, Twitter is very much my main area of nerddom for posting discussions, at Rosie Mayar. I'm involved in the community, so I usually end up bumping into people at, like, virtual events and things like that eventually. And yeah, that's about it. And my book, you can get it. It's through all the major bookstores, really. Through the JKP website as well. And Amazon, major outlets like that. And if you just want to know if it's an indie bookstore, just ask and see if they can put in an order for you, and probably yes.
Fab. I will pop all those links in the show notes so people can just click on them as well if they want to. Cool. Thank you so much for coming on my podcast. It was really interesting to chat to you and learn a little bit more about you and your life and obviously your book as well. I'm definitely going to get a copy. I'm really intrigued to read it after like having spoken to you, which I feel like is quite a kind of privileged position to be in, is to be able to speak to an author and then read their book.
I love that part too, that we live in an age where like you can see a video of someone before you like go see their movie, or yeah. you can watch a guy eat hot wings and feel like you really know them, and next thing you know you're buying their album.
Yeah,
I find that part of the age we're in really exciting.
Yeah, it's nice, isn't it? Definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, thank you so much for coming on.
Yeah, thanks for having me.